Sound?
Hold on here. Yep.
All right.
Here.
I'm going to slate. It's the day with John Taylor Gatto. Roll three. Start with dropping my handkerchief. When we left off, we were talking about how the committees were investigating the foundations. So there was a Cox committee, there was a Reese committee, they were looking into the origins of the education system and what, you know, and what is it really doing versus what do people need to survive and thrive in this world? And they discovered there was a more than a crevasse, more than a Grand Canyon. There was a gap between what we need to survive and thrive and be successful entrepreneurs pursuing the American dream with a real hope of attaining it versus being a servile class. And these committees kind of snapshotted and said that there's some foundations and there's some things in action and they're trying to evoke real change and they're going after our children.
They were puzzled because they detected an agenda, but they couldn't figure the agenda out. And with the second commission, the Reese, a firestorm broke loose. In fact, Reese was never able to finish thanks to the chief counsel. Was that Cox?
The chief counsel, well, I know there was a lawyer involved with the Reese committee, Catherine Casey, who was the lawyer sent by Norman Dodd to go into the archives of the Carnegie Foundation. Yeah. And after being brought up in a traditional, you know, status quo education, she went there and saw the actual minutes and the words of these men in these meetings planning on how to take over this country and to take over the diplomacy and power of war.
Yes, Was Dodd the chief counsel for Reese?
Dodd was the chief researcher, and he was out of J.P. Morgan earlier, and he had said, you guys need to return to sound banking, and they said, Norm, we're going to let you go. And then Carol Reese had called him up and said, Norm, we want you to head up research because we think what they were describing is communist activity from my research, like in the comprehensive
sense.
Well,
they didn't see clear. That was the Bettenwald of the moment, and so that was the easiest way to organize, but it was something far, far more profound than communism. Yes.
Right. So that gets back into Pestalozzi, Lavater, other people who were intellectual elites who joined clubs. It's like the Bavarian Illuminati was one such club that has a lot of the intellectual elite of the area getting together, and in their drawing rooms, they're drawing out the plans for other people's lives. And they basically, when you look at the origins of our education system in America, it goes directly back to Adam Weishaupt's plans, which, you know, are planned on earlier plans, but still there is an organized effort to go after our education system.
Well, there's one more recent than that. There was the Metaphysical Club at Harvard right around the turn of the 20th century, and it contained such muscular figures as William James, who is the reason we have a course in colleges, academic psychology. That's James Prestige brought that in. And James was a kind of, he had a ligature to Wundt, although Wundt intimidated James a bit, because he wrote so much and so copiously about everything. But in the Metaphysical Club, besides William James, was John Dewey, Oliver Wendell Holmes, and a number of other of the shapers of 20th century American institutions. The most important figure, though, is not known to many people. He's perhaps the last major philosopher human history has produced. He was, it's pronounced Pierce, but it's spelled as if it were Pierce. Charles S. Pierce, a strange figure, a part-time lecturer at Harvard, created the pragmatic philosophy that William James was probably the chief distributor of. But your key man's Pierce, because he's much less, how would I put it? He's much more direct than James. James comes from a long intellectual tradition, a genteel tradition, and in a sense, James knows just what to say in every situation. Pierce is very nakedly describing that pragmatism, he doesn't make this connection, but I have, it's very similar to the old Norse religion that said, praise ice when crossed, a woman on her deathbed. In other words, no predeterminations until you see performance. Pierce said the truth and justice flatly do not exist. This was picked up, by the way, by Oliver Wendell Holmes, who then said truth and justice are what the strongest members of society say they are, and any sane judge decides a case before he hears the arguments, because you don't want to rattle the framework of society. I mean, this is big time radicalism. Of course, they didn't see it that way at all. They saw it as nitty-gritty truth and all these superstitious, sentimental additions had occluded the fact justice is what strong people say it is. Truth is same thing.
So that's an evolution of Kantian philosophy, where they remove cause and effect, and then their irrationality can be rationalized.
Yes, of course, they left out Kant's, it's one of the three critiques. The probably the best intellectual defense for the existence of God is from Kant. That was inconvenient for this group. But pragmatism, if you now connect pragmatism with the concept of justified sinning from Calvin, you have an absolute blank check in any situation to invent truth, invent justice, sacrifice biologically inconsequential people, and invent any excuse for doing that you want. Seems to me that's been the driving force in American affairs for a long, long time there. But interestingly enough, it's been the driving force of an intellectual elite, I believe, through history. It's just they didn't have the dominance the technology gave them.
Well, Bertrand Russell has this quote. He's often misquoted, but when you actually read the book, the sentence starts with, I'll paraphrase, as Fichte would have wanted, the purpose of education is to remove individuality and self-reliance and all these other things. So the idea was that Bertrand Russell was noticing that with Fichte in the 19th century was trying to do but didn't have the technology to do, that they now in the Norbert Wiener, Bertrand Russell era of the 20th century, now had the ability to, you know, mass mind control billions of people at the same time. And it's all done on a basis of irrationality, a denial of cause and effect. But that goes back, you know, you could start looking at where the influence of utopia took place and took root in Francis Bacon with New Atlantis and how it goes up. And then it's just formalized by some people using other jargon, psychology, in the 20th century into pragmatism. And it's all just they want to do what they want to do anyway, and they just keep using education to kind of, you know, say, well, this is a good reason why we're doing this.
Yeah. Well, here we are then.
What thoughts do you have about the amount of people in the origins of this country that were literate versus the amount of people that are literate today?
It's quite fascinating because the political census of Connecticut, I believe it was 1690, but don't hold me to that, very, very early on, showed a population that was, for all practical purposes, entirely literate. We also have the more than circumstantial evidence, if you simply look at the popular writing in early colonial times, it's taught in a seminar level in colleges today, and it's as well-known a novel as Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans is in truth unreadable by college friends, not because he's not a skillful writer, but the allusions to science, politics, history of all sorts is so comprehensive and interwoven that the allusions themselves defeat an ordinary reader, including an ordinary college reader. The book I saw in your bathroom, Common Sense, sold 600,000, sold in a population of 3 million, you know, a country that was half serf, slave, and now you can find it on seminar level in Princeton and University of Chicago.
Because so many people were literate at the origins of this country, they were able to publish these pamphlets. Yeah. And so when you'd have propaganda on behalf of the Elector of Hanover, better known as the King of England, and you had these retorts by, you know, Thomas Paine, who's not from America, he emigrated here, and he doesn't have a formal education, but somehow he figures out how to put things together for himself and speak in a way such that the common person can really get something from this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not so much his aspect, you know, his propaganda. He's propagating an idea, but just describe the effect that, you know, just being able to have the printing press and somebody who could pick up these ideas without being through their formal schooling has the power to change and influence a country and inspire revolution, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yes. And in Paine's case, what he had mastered is even today what I tell kids is priceless to master. No complexity of ideas can't, in fact, with the pains on the part of the speaker, the writer, be reduced to plain talk and speech without harming the delicacy of the idea. And Paine really hit that on the button. He's quite a model. In a sense, it's like if you want to write adventure stories, you want to read Edgar Rice Burroughs and the Tarzan books and the Mars books, because you're just propelled from beginning to end on a somewhat more rarefied level. Dickens had that ability. And of course, it could be distributed wholesale, but doing that would hand weapons to people you don't want to be able to be heard. You know, when you teach people to speak and think in academies, you've reduced their effectiveness to their associates there. So, yeah, no, we had some very productive experiments in mass literacy, including a phrase, a label that's vanished from use. There was constant talk of something called the active literacy. As long as you read well, you can develop original thinking, but you can't communicate it. But to be able to master spoken speech, you can talk to anybody and they can actually understand what you're saying, or written speech, were known as the active literacies. The British government made those a crime, a prisonable offense to teach ordinary people the active literacies, not reading, because you want your flunkies to be able to read so they can follow your orders. You can go and play golf or go fishing. But to actually communicate dissident thinking in writing, you can reach way beyond yourself. So the active literacies are, you find in the handful of elite private boarding schools, this tradition preserved. And in fact, in the academy tradition all over the world, there's a clear understanding that to be able to blink your eyes and knock off 300 words on anything at all, including a subject you know nothing about, is de rigueur. And so it is to be able to speak fluently, even on things you don't, well, you can see, and I would love to know how it was done. The current president is masterful, not just good, he's masterful at the nuances of speech. That can only doesn't happen naturally there. Where on earth was that training? There are little figures he uses that have fancy Latin names to them.
Sure.
There. And of course, Bill Clinton was no slouch, but he comes out of a populist preacher tradition and is masterful with what he does. But the other is a formally trained science of speech. And I listen to the modulations and how he can shift from one idiom to another. And I said, somebody with this odd background, you know, all over the world, who's my daddy, who's my mommy, you know, something intervened there. It's no accident, by the way, that Bill Clinton suddenly emerges from a state in which Rockefeller is the governor.
Who was Bill Clinton's mentor?
Well, he has a variety of mentors. The very fact that he steered into Yale, which is probably of the elite universities, the one that keeps the class tradition, the British class tradition, most actively alive. In fact, they all fled from Harvard when the Unitarians took over and are talking, you know, we're all in this together. So they bailed out of Harvard, headed west, dropped the biggest load, no pun intended, in New Haven, but continued on a line that you can trace all the way across to Seattle, leaving behind traces of this brilliant class-based thought. I once, years ago, and don't ask me to reclaim it now, but I once actually did trace the movement from the evacuation of Harvard in about 1805, 1810. What had happened was the Unitarians, who were one of the great heresies of you know, the last 500 years, they worked out a way to initially convert to whatever religion had a church in the area. And then when they were the majority, they would vote the thing out of business, take the assets, and reopen as a Unitarian parish. The entire Massachusetts School Committee, no accident, every last member was a Unitarian, even though there were less than 1% of the Massachusetts population, because they understood leverage. The wolf, what is the symbol of the Fabian socialists in Britain? It's the wolf in sheep's clothing. They have a big laugh at how easy it is, you know, to fool. The funny thing is that Kitty Muggeridge, Beatrice Webb, who is really Fabian socialism, when she carried her husband around, but Beatrice is the welfare state architect. She was the niece of Herbert Spencer, the most articulate intellectual racist in human history. Roodhog or die. She sat with him on his deathbed for 6 weeks, and both of them agreed they were after the identical goals, but by different means. He said, exterminate the brutes, the famous line from Heart of Darkness, and she said, kill them with kindness. You know, I noticed you had Ayn Rand on your shelf. The idea of taking care of somebody else, apart from the innocent charitable thing, is that you ruin them by doing that. It doesn't take very long to ruin them. So Beatrice Webb, the Fabian, and the great conservative Herbert Spencer, same bloodline, same goals, different methodology.
Fabian socialists also founded the London School of Economics, yes, among many other things. Sidney and Beatrice Webb were working with Arthur Balfour and the Society for Psychical Research, I believe. And one of the other characters that was spinning in that crowd was a guy named William T. Stead, who was editor of the Review of the Reviews, died in the Titanic, and was the editor-in-chief over that last will and testament of Cecil John.
Yeah. And of course, and I have no idea how he pronounced his name, but I would call it Steed. It was the character in The Lady with the Black Leather, what was... a sort of international spy series on television about 20 years ago. Diana Rigg, what was the female lead,
yeah.
And Steed was an inside joke.
Kind of like the James Bond films are an inside joke to MI6 and Ian Fleming's whole career. And James Bond was an ornithologist, which is a bird watcher, which is what James Bond is. He's watching girls and playing this whole game for the De Beers cartel, which controls.
And if you believe in justified sinning, that's what a license to kill is. It's for Her Majesty or whoever.
Well, and Thomas Paine had some words to write about where monarchies draw their idealistic power and who created crowns and these sort of ideas where somebody is born into a situation where they're allowed to rule over other people, and that's a collectivist mentality where they expect you to sacrifice yourself to the state. So Prussian schooling is definitely created to uphold that status quo. What is the equal and opposite? How do people transition themselves and remain individual and grow and learn and do these things for themselves?
Well, I think there are a variety of smaller inspirations. Besides the fact that, if you and I are correct, it's the natural instinct of people who've sort of been made aware of the life and the arc of a life. But oddly enough, the Congregationalists are very, the little white-spired, beautiful churches that once, I believe, you couldn't vote in this state unless you were one. They taught that the Presbyterians, as Milton said, new presbyter is but old priest writ large, because they met together once a year. And he said, that will ruin you, having this collective mentality. The congregation is sovereign in a real congregationalist church. I don't know how they've mutated through history. And the minister is simply, you know, the official of the moment to organize the back and forth. But the minute the minister becomes cheeky or out of line, out he goes, and usually if he asks for more money, because the minister is a functionary, the congregation gets the word directly from God. This is, of course, Martin Luther's enormous breakthrough, which he couldn't sustain. That that's probably the great freeing line in human history. Every man his own priest. No organization is necessary. The communication's direct. Congregationalists modified it and said there's some value in other people's opinion, but not too many others. The people who show up and donate to the church, yeah, we want to hear what they all have to say. But the minister, you know. So that was one source for a long time, these dissenting and independent religions that were unwelcome in Britain came here, and there's so much space, and it was so disorganized outside of cities. I mean, we had this infinite splintering. So that was one sort. I think the scale of the country itself, which couldn't be really monitored until very recently. Long ago, it occurred to me that when you have to depend on, say, horses, no telephones, no iPads, when you get about 20 miles from the center, they don't know what you're doing. Once a year, blue moon, they send somebody out, and you say whatever the guy wants to hear. Back goes, it looks like everything's cool. That's how we had. There are no continuous governments in human history. None of them last very long, and I'm sure it's because this ferment on the fringe, which isn't very far away, eventually is fatal to the idea that, you know, the hierarchy must be preserved.
I think that's just a sign that there's so many people in this country. When things can get that obviously irrational, that there's just no intellectual self-defense, there's no one left to form, you know, a sentence, let alone a paragraph, let alone have the power to get it printed in front of millions of people anymore. And that's what I noticed.
And no editor would dare print it anyway for fear the ads would dry up.
Senator Oscar Calloway, in 1917, addressed to Congress, and he said that the J.P. Morgan interest, the shipbuilding powder interests, had all gotten together and bought the top editor. You know, they placed editors at the top 25 newspapers in order to control the content on political policy and military policy. So that was really the declaration, the first origins of the Council on Foreign Relations, which goal is to kind of control and mold the minds of the masses using official experts and historians. And
so these clues won't leak. How about Harry Truman's speech before the U.S. Senate in 1942 denouncing the Rockefeller interests as traitors because they were selling oil to both sides? What he didn't know was that the Krupp cannon makers were doing the same thing, making the German cannon, selling them to the French or anyone else who would buy them. They had already become a virtual global society. But Truman's denunciation of the Rockefellers on the floor of the Senate, you would think that would be just elementary sharing with generations of school kids. No, doesn't exist for all practical purposes, unless you're willing to sit in the, well, my generation, sit in the library stacks and go through. I did that in Columbia. I said, I'm going to find out. Oh, no, I'm going back to 1958. So I got a stack pass. I've heard about stack pass. I'm down like in the sixth level. There's these huge stacks of popular magazines. It says, you know, I'm interested to find out what the popular newspapers and magazines said about the Second World War before it started. For like the 90 days before it started, let me tell you, to a publication, there not only was a certainty there was going to be war, But no worry at all. They all agreed that there was no ability on the part of any potential enemy to sustain a war, that all the gains would be right away, then they couldn't replace their losses. I noted that Quigley said, not only did the British start the war with a larger air force than the Germans and more advanced technologically, but they could replace their losses and the Germans couldn't and the Japs couldn't at all. So they ended the war with the same plane they began the war with. Well, this was understood before we had a war. This is a good way to get out of the Depression. Good way to cow dissidents in the population always is to declare a national emergency. Then you have an excuse for foreclosing freedom of speech.
What did Quigley do that was so unique or remarkable that no one else had done before?
Well, what Carol Quigley, the head of the Foreign Service Department at Georgetown University, no marginal school, what he did was use his invitation to be the only human being ever invited to view the files of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I believe its predecessor also. What he did was to actually write a major piece of nonfiction. It must be 1,300 words long, pages long. Fairly small print. And he made the fatal mistake of being a superb writer and thinker so that it's accessible to anyone who gets a hold of a copy of the book. That was quite impossible beginning 6 months after the book was published. And I can just see the manuscript must have been this big. So an editor asked to vet the thing and make sure. Yeah. And after all, Georgetown, this guy's saved. Out it goes. Macmillan publishes it. Sells out instantly. Instantly. And any conspiracy theory you've ever heard of is documented, only not as a conspiracy theory. Gives you the name, the date, the time, the actual letters. Oh, good God. Well, somebody got hung for that. Macmillan broke the plates, told Quigley there was no interest in the book at all, broke the plates so it couldn't be reprinted. Quigley's on a tape recording right at the end of his life that's stored down in Georgetown in the stacks, saying that they lied to him, that they had tons of, who wouldn't want to read the book? I spent 6 months looking for a copy of the book and finally found one in the rare book room at New York University and had it stolen. And then a couple of months later, because I'd looked in so many cities, I got a call, mysterious call, from a fellow, I think he turned out to be a dentist, had a radio show.
Who is?
Okay.
It's Stan Monteith.
Yes, Stan Monteith. He said, I understand you're looking for, well, I said, do you know where? Yes, he said, I have some copies. Of course, he had reprinted the copies. And after Monteith, over the next couple of years, several other people had taken the Macmillan and reprinted it so much, in fact, that it became the basis for a growing number of aware people. They weren't sure what they were aware of, other than that the story was not as delivered, not in junior high and not at Harvard. It was a different story. It was a story that could accommodate two fraternity brothers at Yale running against one another for president. The big agenda. But Quigley's real gift to the rest of us is his absolute mastery of prose and his really interesting mind and his confession that he agreed with the plot. He simply, as a good Roman Catholic, didn't apply it with the secrecy. He said, I believe there's nothing anyone can do about this anyway. It was marvelous. I go back whenever I feel despair. And not an easy, I mean, it's an easy read because it's so well written, but it's a big chunk. He says, for example, that the only times liberties ever appeared in human society is when the population is privately armed with deadly weapons. And to reach the acme of liberty, they have to have the same weapons available to them that the government has available to them. And yet we're not talking about some guy who rolls his collar up. We're talking about this internationally famous scholar. So,
well, at the beginning, you know, the American Revolution, the people who were fighting against the British government had equal arms. You know, they were landowners. They had sure. They had interest to fight over it. That stopped being equal in the 1930s with mechanized warfare and mass production because they've had Prussian education in place for 80 years and now everyone's an obedient worker, and Amtssprache allows a lot of people to do things that they normally wouldn't do, but now it's part of their job and now it's their responsibility and now it's their duty, and all the things that Milgram drove home through his experiments. Look, these people will kill other people if you put a white coat on.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's quite exciting. I mean, it's a hideous turn in human history, but it's quite exciting. The comprehensive surveillance mechanism prevents local groups from developing armament. These Arabs have done the only thing of which there isn't a successful defense, and that's to blow, just what the Japs did at the end of World War II, to blow themselves up, to blow babies up, to blow, not women very often, but still they're beginning to appear as human weapons. What you can do is suppress that activity, but you can't do it and say, this is a free society and we're all in the game together.
There are four copies, I think, of Tragedy and Hope around. Have you seen the first edition?
I have, and I'm wondering when Macmillan has been forced to reprint it very recently, in the last year or two. And I'm wondering, you only have to delete key sections, still be a big book, to take the real sting out of it. I thought somebody with young eyes and a lot of stamina ought to sit with the original edition and the reprint just to make sure.
So we're doing tomorrow afternoon. We have a first edition and we have several other reprints, and we're gonna...
Oh, do let me know, because I have other people I'm trying to see the idea, and I could say there's the project's underway. I want you to send them a little check. And, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think about Quigley's book, Anglo-American Establishment?
You know, I was impressed by the thinking and the scholarship, but I think the presentation puts it beyond the reach, not beyond the understanding, but beyond the reach of ordinary people without a coach. And I do think we have a pressing need to find, without diluting the complexity, to find the idiom. I think I said to Rich earlier, it drives me insane. There are things I've been rewriting for years because I'll try them out and I'll feel that an audience misses how that plugs in.
It's almost as if the audience needs a little bit of you know, re-inspiring their curiosity, but then giving them a methodology by which they can start to reignite their learning.
Very important.
Once they bring their attention and consciousness up a little bit, then they can receive some of these other messages.
Yes.
In the meantime, we can be coaches and help them kind of get that.
We mentioned this earlier, but the great favor Charles Darwin did for people like me is to indict the Irish as hopeless biology, because my audiences are full Irishers, and I say, don't trust an old broken down school teacher. Pick the book up and go to the Irish sections, because it's unmistakable his scorn and contempt to dismiss them as irredeemable. The Spanish is irredeemable. There's quite a little catalog of people, not Swedish blondes, mind you.
No, but Darwin does that because instead of observing how things actually work, they were trying to carry out an agenda. So he creates these ideas, and he said, under these ideas, you people can do what you want, and it's going to make them hopeless. And if you think you're hopeless, then you're not really aspiring to climb up any ladder, because there's no ladder, because you've been told you're hopeless.
Right.
And he gets them to basically self-amputate their curiosity, and then they bring in compulsory schooling, and that cauterizes the whole thing. And they're like, well, you won't be curious anymore asking questions.
I think Darwin himself had a lot of, and he's not innocent, but he had a lot of innocence in his character. Galton has none. Galton knows exactly where to drop these things to cause maximum damage and to institutionalize the anti-educational nature of school. Once it's institutionalized, nobody has to know what's going on. That's the way you make your living. And if you were, for example, to extend the privileges of partial autonomy among school kids, you would shrink the establishment. And that is no way to retain power or income. If you were to find substitutions for the purchased supposed improvements in curriculum, I mean, the truth is, superb education doesn't cost a penny to deliver. If you understand what it is, what you're aiming for, and what you can use, it's a lot easier if you have money. But what money's usually used for is to purchase layer after layer of interventions, and those interventions prevent the educational result.
Compare and contrast how Adam Smith felt about money and the earning of it to sustain oneself versus today, where it's just earned to buy more and compulsory, you know, status, what do you say, so status symbols? You know, conspicuous consumption, these ideas.
I must tell you, I used to be enough of a favorite at the Cato Institute that I was named the Secretary of Education in their shadow cabinet. That has to be, did you know Marshall Fritz?
No, I don't know Marshall.
Okay, he was a legendary member. When I discovered what Adam Smith actually said, which I wouldn't deny that key people at Cato also know, I became very, very problematical, because in the theory of moral sentiments, Smith, I'm going to give a shorthand here. Smith says that to spend your time making money as a mark of insanity, and what it will buy you is a bad life. But we should be grateful to the people who do that, because they assemble capital, they pay the biggest price, and they create, improvements for everybody else. I don't think the religion of libertarian capitalism wishes that complication to be well understood, because there's no way to explain it away. He, just as he's very clear, that the peasants and the dukes under the same people. He's very, very clear. You got to be nuts to assemble capital.
What lessons can be learned from Ben Franklin?
Yeah, Franklin's life is the best lesson. Franklin was such, I almost slipped into Pittsburgh profanity, but I won't. Franklin was not a morally nice human being in any way. In fact, his son broke off contact with him and never spoke to him again for 40 years for the rest of their life. So Franklin was the ultimate pragmatist. He masqueraded as a Quaker, even though he had no ties whatsoever. The French who financed the revolution talked about this marvelous Quaker. I mean, he was like a national sensation over there. And he didn't disguise in his dress. I mean, he camouflaged himself sort of. He always walked a line where he could justify what he was doing. But his life is evidence from a huge, they're probably a lower middle class family, a candle maker. They always had food on the table, but his autobiography is worth its weight in gold many times because he explains how you can introduce the highest level curriculum imaginable to 10, 11-year-old people that his father, who had no touch with, you know, scholastic theory, would bring in every night a stranger from the street, set an extra place at table so that the, you know, in-house culture could be infused with fresh input there. That he and his friends decided that without mastering high-level written prose, their opportunity, I mean, he's 11 years old, and they say, how are we going to get a big-time literary style when nobody, you know, they take the New Yorker magazine of the day, The Tatler and the Spectator, written, read by only the most hoity-toity, and they rewrote the articles in their own words and then would present the rewrite to strangers and say, pardon me, sir, could you tell me where this article might have come from? And when everyone said, oh, that's Tatler or Spectator, they knew they had mastered that. Come on, they wouldn't do that at Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. These are 11, 12-year-old boys. And he's doing it while he's working a 60-hour week at labor. And he's putting capital aside for his own business by selling beer to the printers at their lunch hour. How does he get to do that? Goes to the owner of the print shop and he says, look, you're letting these guys go for lunch. Some of them are coming back woozy. Some of them are not coming back at all. Let me bring the buckets of beer in, make a penny, and they'll be chained to the machine. That's Ben Franklin, mind you. So his accomplishments, I mean, he's the reason we have a post office. He's the reason there's a University of Pennsylvania. He's probably the reason the German isn't a coeval in Pennsylvania, because all these little German potus groups were not speaking English any more than, you know, they could get by with. And he found ways to put political pressure and penalties on them if their kids weren't surrendered to English training. Now, he's a miraculous example of what nobody can do if they know what to do and have some discipline, mind you. I would say nobody should not read Franklin's autobiography very, very slowly. Do not read it for the story, but for the details. And you have a formula that anybody could use. So there's for Ben Franklin.
What could a student learn from the life experiences, young life experiences of Thomas Edison?
Well, Mr. Edison, from New Jersey, begged his mother not to waste his time sending him to school. That's before he was 12 years old, and to allow him to go west where during the Civil War, where opportunity was burgeoning. And she let him do it 1,000 miles from home. He became a train boy. That's the lowest job imaginable. You know, at whistle stops, you go out and buy sodas or coffee. You know, you're everybody's factotum. But he talked the train into letting him put a broken down printing press in the boxcar. And then during the Civil War, because he was able to connect things into new realities, he knew that the train stations got Civil War news at the same time the newspapers did. But the newspapers didn't come out to certain hours. He used his printing press to run current Civil War news instead of auctioning off children at the whistle stops. He sold the Grand Trunk Herald. And because he wasn't the nicest guy in the world, he varied the price from a nickel to a quarter, depending on what the audience could pay. He put together a substantial stake that founded his own. Plus, he used the stake in the years he was doing this to start 3 businesses, each one of which depended on the advantage he had by going up and down the Michigan length there. Now, let me see. I'm years away from one of them. One of them was that he could distribute magazines and newspapers free. He'd just pick them up at some drop point, and he could put anyone out of business because he didn't really have to charge much to do that. There were a couple of others. I think one was a food business, so that when he ran out to get something for the passengers, he was the owner of the business. And there was a third one. He, of course, has 1,007 patents without a day in college. In fact, when he founded GE, it wasn't called GE, but that's what it became, he made the test for hiring executive staff so hard that he used to laugh and say, nobody with a college degree can pass this test. Now notice, if all of this documented history was, and it's your birthright, if this were shared with you in third grade and fourth grade and fifth grade, notice that you would arrive at the age of 12 with a whole different idea of what your prospects were, rather than your hand shaking because you got a C on your report card, and that probably would doom your career. It's a colossal crime, and I'm speaking now as a detective story fan. I'm staying away from the moral high ground here because it's so far beyond what we define as good and evil. And for the people who do this, it is good because, as as Darwin's Malthus, as Thomas Malthus says clearly in his essay, climbing the mountain, the high ground, the moral mountain. He says it's a kindness. These people are doomed to such miserable lives that to hasten their demise is a great kindness to them. You work them to death, you starve them. You're doing God's work. He, of course, was a parson of the Church of England, which Charles was trained to be, but you know, left in Galton.
We had people like Lippmann and Bernays who recognized that people were inherently irrational. And instead of trying to teach them critical thinking, they say, let's use fear and confusion to control them even
more.
That's
Spinoza as the author of that. Get a hold of, they're around, a translation of Tractatus Religico-Politicus, published in 1690. And any outlook you have on Spinoza will change radically. You're in the hands of a man who could put Adolf Hitler and his high command in the shade. He had worked out all the way. There weren't any escape loopholes. And he sold the plan to monarchs, you know, who had a long, hard slug to sell it to. You know, the traditional upper classes who still had scraps of morality, traditional morality. They still hadn't become justified sinners. Thomas Jefferson, in Notes on the State of Virginia, he's trying to assemble, because Spinoza's ideas are already in America, so he's trying to assemble the possible good use that could come out of an institution of schooling. That's why shallow teacher college texts said that Jefferson was one of the pioneers. But what Jefferson said was that unless five things are done, it will be a mere secular religion. And as soon as I saw it, that's Spinoza's direct positive program to get rid of emotional religion. That's a wild card. Secular religion's okay. I mean, that's what the Church of England is. Wasn't inspired. Men sat around in committees and figured out what God would want.
We have 1 minute left on this tape for today. My question would be, in the last minute, who was Niccolo Machiavelli, and why should every school child take a gander at what Niccolo...
You've got to take a gander at Machiavelli. Machiavelli was a Florentine at a time when Italy wasn't a unified nation. It was a collection of powerful city-states, or at least some were, and Florence was one of the most powerful, but it had important rivals. And Machiavelli, he was a middle-level politician, call him. And he was ambitious. So he wanted to, it was the famous Borgia family.
Cesare Borgia and Medici family.
Yeah. He wanted to do what Henry Kissinger did, is to establish himself as a fountain of utility for the Borgias. And he really had an excellent mind, and it's hard to tell what his character was because he has other books that are rather morally grounded. But for the first time in history, the secrets that have been talked about in drawing rooms maybe leaked a little bit, like Hobbes' Leviathan there. Suddenly it was an unbroken presentation of how the prince should maintain and enlarge his power there. It electrified the planet. First of all, the people who already knew these things were ticked. And the people who suspected them were put in a moral quandary, a bind. Now it would be a deliberate choice. But for the great unwashed and for the religious power that represented them, here was, and his name was, after all, Nick. Here was old Nick saying, here. You know, we could give us 10 years and no one could pass through school without being aware of these high or low points in the creation of their own society. Then at least they would have choices. And I know some would choose to sell out.
But others, because of that that romantic quality in the young, you know, that's why we send them over to get blown up, you know, would they do what they did in the 60s. This is a turning point in American history. After national policy.
Is that tape end? Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to turn the lights off. You can continue talking. I'll just mark where we are.
Oh, this probably ought to be on. But remind me tomorrow, I'll do this. After national policy was contradicted by the riffraff in colleges and high schools, word went out that was never to happen again. A group called the Trilateral Commission published a book they subsidized at NYU. It's worth picking up. It's called The Crisis of Democracy, 1975. And in shorthand, the crisis is, if the people take it seriously, we've got trouble on our hands. So we've got to hide power and how decisions are made even more rigorously than they've done in the past. Just like Hobbes said, power is never where it seems to be. Not us, it's never there. Those are always the, you know, the flat catcher.
If only Hobbes was writing for the average person, if only the person was literate, if only they had critical thinking so that when they were so that their literacy didn't make them a slave.
Yeah, or make them think of people like Hobbes. Oh, it's just another book. It's a man's book. Yeah. That's his opinion. Well, he was the advisor of the king, and the book stayed in print, you know, for 450 years.
It's actually in the great book set. It's in with Machiavelli and Hobbes, in volume 23. From that set over there.
The Harvard Classic thing.
It's the great books of the Western world.
Oh, yeah.
Put together by
Chicago. I was accepted to the University of Chicago when I was a sophomore in high school, and my mother wouldn't let me go. And my uncle, who graduated from